Just give me your name and maybe some of your background.
Yeah, I'm Mark Bertram. I'm the lead wildlife biologist for Yukon Flats Refuge here in Fairbanks. I've been here for 20 years, since 93. I've been with Fish and Wildlife Service since 86. My background is in wildlife management, and that's primarily why I'm working for U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Mm-hmm. And here at the refuge, my primary responsibilities are just managing or supervising the biological program. That's just one segment of what we do here at the refuge. And so it's a little bit about where I am. I'm originally from Missouri, went to University of Missouri, got a degree in wildlife management.
Mm-hmm. Could you kind of give me an overview of the Yukon Flats Wildlife Refuge? You know how?
Sure, yeah. Well, it's diverse. I guess if I had to use one word to describe it, I would say diverse. It's a huge expanse. It's very large also, but within that huge expanse, it's just very diverse. And I guess some of the diversity, most of the diversity just comes from the land out there. You know, there's a huge wetland basin. There's a 10,000 square mile wetland basin, the Yukon Flats Basin, within the boundaries of the refuge. And that wetland basin, you know, comprises probably about 30% of the actual land base out there. But considering we're talking about 17,000 square miles, you know, a considerable portion of that is a wetland basin. And that's really what gives the Yukon Flats its international acclaim, is the wetland basin. And getting back to the diversity, within the wetland basin, there's somewhere between 10 and 30,000 lakes and ponds, depending on what you use to call a lake or a pond. If you call it, you know, something less than an acre, we probably got about 30 to 40,000 lakes and ponds out there. But if you're looking at something a little larger than that, maybe not so many lakes and ponds. But it's got all these lakes and ponds, and what's interesting is that they're very different. Different water chemistry, different vegetation types surrounding each of those wetlands, different water levels. Some are very deep, up to 100 feet deep. Many are very, very shallow. And, you know, the geology around it contributes to, you know, what makes that water basin up as well. And what this all equates to is really diverse types of lakes and ponds. And what that means is that it really attracts a lot of wildlife, especially waterfowl. And so this basin is home to some of the highest densities of waterfowl nesting in Alaska. And so it's got an international reputation as being a big breeding area for waterfowl. And so a lot of what we do is designed around managing the waterfowl. I mean, we do much, much more than that. That's one of the driving forces for us.
Isn't the Yukon River a big part of that?
Huge. Huge. Yeah, the Yukon River bisects the refuge. It goes right down through the heart of the refuge. And, you know, all these lakes and ponds that I was just referring to are all adjacent to the Yukon River. So, you know, as we had a huge flood year this year, so a lot of those lakes and ponds were recharged by the Yukon River. So it's all one big system. I call it kind of like the lifeblood going through the refuge, because not only do you have the water coming through, all those nutrients that are coming through and being shared with those lakes and ponds, we've got five villages that are directly on those rivers, on that Yukon River within the refuge. So, you know, and that's not a coincidence that people live on the Yukon River, you know, because it's historically a logistical place, you know, a good place to be logistically. And it's where a lot of the resources are. You know, it's also the Yukon River is our, for instance, it's also a huge wintering ground for what moose we have on the Yukon Flats. So it's a very important feature.
Could you mention those villages by name?
Well, let's just go downstream and we'll work our way upstream. Stevens Village is on the western end of the refuge down in the southwest corner. Stevens Village is, there must be about 100 to 150 residents there. Primarily, well, they have a mixture of both Athabascan and Gwich'in Native Americans living there. And then it's kind of a border for that, you know, because downriver, there's a lot of Koyukon, Athabascan. Upriver, it's more Gwich'in. And then as you go upstream to Beaver, Beaver's the next village up. Beaver's about the same size, around 100 to 150 residents. That's an interesting village because, people who've read history, and I'm sure you know Frank Yasuda was the one who founded Beaver years and years ago. And he was a Japanese man. So there's a lot of ethnic mixture out there. Now, adjacent to Beaver, not really on the Yukon River, there's a tributary that comes into the Yukon River called Birch Creek. And up Birch Creek, about 100 and so miles, is the village of Birch Creek, which is a very small village. About 30 people reside there at the most. It's a very small village, that's Birch Creek. And then as you go upstream from Beaver on up the Yukon River, you'll hit the Chandler River. That's another huge tributary coming into the Yukon. You go another, I'm not even sure about the miles, it might be 50 to 80 miles upstream, you'll hit the village of Enatai. And that's another, that's a very large village. You have about 200 people living there. Back down to the Yukon River, going upstream, you'll hit Fort Yukon, and that's kind of the hub of interior Alaska for this eastern interior region that we're in. And Fort Yukon has got 600 to 700 people living there. It probably goes up and down a little bit seasonally, but it's the hub. And then if you were to go up the Porcupine, which is the mouth is right adjacent to Fort Yukon. If you're going to go up the Porcupine and then go up the Black River, you'll hit Chalkeetsuk, and that's up in the northeast corner of the refuge. And there are, again, about 100 to 150 people. Then, as you continue on upstream, really the outer edge of the eastern part of the refuge down in the southeast corner is the village of Circle. And that's that really completes the villages that are either on or adjacent to the Yukon Flats. Central's fairly close also. Arctic Village is pretty far distant of Venati, but there's a lot of interaction between Venati and Arctic Village ethnically. And so there's just a lot of families that exchange back and forth there. But those are the primary villages that we deal with on mm-hmm. Yukon Flats.
Since the land claims, there's been a lot of village selections within the refuge. How's that worked out?
Well, it's an ever ongoing process. BLM is in the process of still finalizing all these land claims that were made back in 72. And it's an ongoing process. We are constantly adjusting our land status maps because we get word through BLM that there's been a selection that's been settled. And, most of those selections are minor adjustments. The thing that we're probably more involved with than anything else are we have a lot of native allotments on the refuge also. And so there's a huge number of native allotments out there. Which means there's small private landholders out there. So we consult with people about the native allotment status out there. But really, the thing that's happened to us recently is we just recently went through a proposal by one of the native village corporations, Doi Unlimited, and it was to have a land exchange. And the land exchange did not take place, but it brought to light that, those types of things could happen. And so this particular land exchange was exchanging native village lands for refuge lands. And, you know, got into an environmental impact statement to make the final decision, and the public weighed in, the native villages weighed in, and there was enough enough public sentiment against the land exchange that it didn't take place. But, you know, so those are some of the things that can happen out there as far as land acquisitions go.
Mm-hmm. What's the Fish and Wildlife Service's primary responsibility in terms of the wildlife?
Well, we've got four purposes that we follow. I mean, it's kind of our directive from Congress. And the first one is to conserve fish and wildlife and their habitats and their natural diversity. And, you know, and so we have, as I mentioned earlier, we've got a very significant wetland habitat on the refuge. And so we do focus on that a lot, and so we do a lot of inventory and monitoring of waterfowl resources. And we also are focused on the habitat that those populations live on. So, you know, and probably the one thing that we make annual decisions on is fire management. You know, that really sculpts the land out there, and each year, you know, the refuge manager, Steve here, will get a phone call from the fire management officer, and we've got to make a decision on what to do with a certain fire. We have different types of fire management categories depending on where the land is located. And generally speaking, the closer it is to a populated area, the more likely it is that we're going to take some type of an action to put the fire out, or try to control it, or direct it, although it's not very practical to really try to direct fire in Alaska, as you know. And then a lot of the areas that are away from the populated areas are in what they call limited areas, and we'll let those areas grow. And, you know, from a management standpoint, when you're trying to conserve wildlife populations and promote their growth, the habitat's very important. So fire, from our perspective, is a good thing. It helps to reshape the landscape. It's part of the natural process out there. So fire, also like flooding, can be very destructive depending on how you look at it. But flooding also, although flooding in the right place can do good things also. You know, we had severe floods in Circle and in Stevens Village this year, and especially Circle. And, you know, it can be just, you know, do very, a lot of damage for, you know, the populated areas. But when you get off the populated areas and you get out on the river corridor, out on the Yukon River, that's the mechanism that recharges wetlands. So I got a little off track there. Our second purpose that we have on the refuge is to fulfill our international treaty obligations, and we have there's waterfowl treaties and there's salmon treaties, and so we have a treaty with Canada. As many Alaskans know, you know, we have to allow a certain number of salmon to pass over the U.S. border over into Canada each year, so we follow that obligation, and then we also we also have waterfowl treaties set up with Canada and with Mexico. So, you know, we try to adjust harvest and bag limits internationally, you know, because these are international resources. The birds don't know boundaries. And birds on the Yukon Flats they go to Russia, they go to Mexico, they go down to the Bahamas, they go to all of the lower 48 states. They go down to Central America to winter, all those areas. And so this is a breeding ground, a primary breeding ground for a big, you know, amalgamation of birds come up to the Yukon Flats. So we provide a real critical role there. So we talked about conserving wildlife and their natural diversity. We talked about international treaty obligations. The next thing we have to do is we have to ensure adequate water quality and quantity. Okay, and that is an important purpose for us. just as an example, what that means is we're very, you know, we have a very pristine environment that we currently have up here in Alaska compared to the lower 48. And so, you know, we try to maintain that quality of resource out on the refuge. And, you know, it's very difficult to do because, you know, as people who know water right, you know, his history of water rights know is that it's very difficult to control water. And so most of the water is coming from outside our boundaries and coming in because we have the Yukon River flowing right through us. We're very concerned about the headwaters on the refuge that feed into the refuge. We'd like to make sure that the headwaters stay adequate so that, you know, they don't contaminate, you know, any of the resources that are on the Yukon Flats. So that's, you know, that's something that we're very concerned about. The last objective, the last purpose that the refuge has is to maintain is to offer a subsistence opportunity to all the local residents within the Yukon Flats. And so it's called a subsistence priority in the federal government. And so we're mandated to provide that opportunity. So, you know, that subsistence opportunity could be hunting, it could be fishing, it could be berry picking, it could be, you know, the opportunity to go out and trap. And so we make sure that our management actions don't interfere with or don't take away from local residents' ability to, you know, to do subsistence activities on the refuge.
You use the word local residents. That's probably the key word there, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And when I say local residents, I'm really referring to those residents of those villages that we named earlier. There's about 1,200 people that live within the boundaries of the Yukon Flats or adjacent to it.
It seems to me when Anilka created a lot of the wildlife refuges, the villagers really like the idea because it would protect the subsistence resources over other designations. So it seems to me there's been a lot of welcoming of the refuge area because of the interconnection with villages and refuges.
Yeah, I'd say we've got a good working relationship with the villages. We try to interact with them as much as possible, and generally we're welcomed in the villages when we go out and, you know, whether we're going to a public meeting or we're maybe conducting some kind of biological project out of a certain village, we have facilities in two of the villages, we have an office and a cabin up in Fort Yukon. We have a fueling facility there. And we also have a kind of a storage facility and a fueling facility down in Beaver. So those are strategically placed to some degree to allow us to work out there. So we're doing a lot of gas flying back and forth from Fairbanks. But as you mentioned earlier, we do have a good working relationship. People generally welcome the subsistence priority purpose that refuges have. I mean, it's really to their advantage, I think, in many, many ways. And so I think they recognize that as a positive thing. So in that regard, it's, you know, it's, there's nothing contentious about it at all, you know, so it's kind of a win-win for us and for them, so it works out well with our relationship.
Yeah. No, the contentious area I want to get into is the resource development in terms of oil and gas or minerals. Has there been some pushing into the basin? It seems to me some oil company was drilling around the basin.
Yeah, I talked earlier about a land exchange, a proposed land exchange, and really the underlying purpose of that land exchange was to access oil and gas on federal lands. There is, you know, there's been seismic work done on the Yukon Flats since the 1970s, mm-hmm. and there's a lot of open knowledge, and there's also a lot of proprietary information out there regarding oil and gas reserves. And my understanding is that if you look at the land ownership pattern on the Yukon Flats, you'll see that even though we've got this 11 million acre refuge, a quarter of that is privately owned. So we have a large part of the inholdings in the refuge are privately owned. So 2.5 million of those 11 million acres are privately owned. And those are owned by native corporations and by the villages themselves. And one of the native corporations is Doi Unlimited. And Doi Unlimited works with native villages and interacts with the federal government to, create jobs and to develop resources across Alaska. They're the largest private landowner in the United States. So kind of backtracking a little bit, if you look at the land status through the Yukon Flats, you'll see this checkerboard pattern where we've got, maybe a 500 or 800 or maybe 1,000 square mile section around each of the villages that provides kind of a buffer between the federal lands and the villages themselves. That's a big private buffer. And the ownership pattern is arranged by township, and basically Doyon and the Native Village Corp and the Native Villages kind of, when they selected lands back in the early 70s, they selected kind of a checkerboard pattern. And that was to maximize the footprint around the village. And in those days, they were really thinking about natural resource development, oil and gas development. And so that issue's been around for a long, long time. So the proposed land exchange, and here's a figure we can look at that kind of shows the land, mm-hmm. how much private land there is out there. And so part of the land exchange was to exchange some of the private lands for some of the federal lands, and what that would have, if the deal would have gone through, it would have given Doi Unlimited access to some federal lands that they don't have access to right now. And as I mentioned earlier, that deal did not go through. And as a result, Doyon is actively pursuing oil and gas development over by Stevens Village. And so there's seismic work that's going on over there right now. It's happened two times in the last three winters. And so there is movement afoot for oil and gas development on the Yukon Flats. And, it's starting out down by Stevens Village right now. And so that's of concern to us. We're not against resource development at all, but we are also interested in protecting, the biological resources on the federal lands within the refuge. So we've got to balance that. And then we're also equally concerned, as I mentioned earlier, about any developments that are going to affect the watersheds, such as mining, and so we have the opportunity. The areas around us, around the refuge, many of the areas around us that are open to mining, are managed by BLM and the state of Alaska, and so we do have the opportunity to weigh in on. As management plans, conservation plans are being developed for those areas, and we've had that opportunity in the last several years to, to weigh in on some of the management plans that BLM has been putting together for areas in the White Mountains, for instance, south of the refuge, and in areas over on the eastern part of the refuge. Those are also part of those same management plans.
Well, you've done a good job. Let's see here. Like the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, Congress can change this, I suppose, can't they? Through congressional, there's always a pressure on the North Slope on the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. It doesn't feel like it's here.
Does it? No, it doesn't. I can't. I think it probably has a lot to do with that proprietary data.
Mm.
You know, I think maybe the proprietary data up there is pretty, you know, it's got a big bullseye on it. I can't, you know, I do think we have oil and gas reserves under the Yukon Flats Basin. Where they're all at and where they're concentrated, I can't really tell you. But no, there hasn't been as much political pressure targeted at the Yukon Flats, for sure. So I think it's, you know, it's a pretty, you know, it's a pretty unique area, and it's got a lot of people living in the middle of it. An interesting side note that I didn't get into at the beginning that I'm sure you're aware of, Roger, is the, I'm just going to give you a little bit of history, and that's the Rampart Dam project.
I was going to ask that next.
And, you know, I think this, the Rampart Dam might be a good example of why possibly we don't have the big target on us for oil and gas development. And so, you know, back in the 50s, I think it was Senator Gruning, was proposing to dam up the Yukon River down by Rampart. And so that was a real, you know, ominous proposal to a lot of people, especially the 1,000 or so people living in the Yukon Flats. And so, you know, what that means is if that dam had happened, the Yukon Flats, as we know it, would be one large reservoir. Everything beneath about 300 foot elevation would have been water. And, you know, that would include most of the villages that are on the Yukon River, and Birch Creek Village and Chalkeetsuk. Chalkeetsuk might be right on the edge, but they would be probably underwater also. So that proposal met a lot of scrutiny, and it really laid the foundation for our biological program. Because what happened was Fish and Wildlife Service was charged with collecting, you know, they had to do an EIS, it was kind of before the environmental impact statements were required, before the Endangered Species Act of 1973, before all that. But they had to, you know, there had to be some type of information collected to base this decision on. So what happened was some biologists from the Fish and Wildlife Service, this is before the Yukon Flats was actually formed, they were designated to come up here and ban ducks. Because everybody knew in the area that this is a big wetland basin. It was probably important for waterfowl. We didn't know just how much. But they came up, and what they did was they banded over 40,000 ducks over a four-year period. And a lot of that happened on some of the really large lakes across the Yukon Flats. And as I mentioned earlier, I talked about where these waterfowl go for their wintering areas. All that banding information was how they determined that. And so we found out that this was an international breeding ground for waterfowl. And, you know, I think there were a lot of other reasons that the dam didn't happen. I think economically, I don't think it was probably a well thought out idea. So, I mean, it was probably a hard sell. And, you know, all the local villages were against it, was my understanding from reading some of the transcripts. But yeah, so the Rampart Dam came and went, the idea came and went. It hasn't been proposed since. And I think it probably, you know, for obvious reasons wouldn't be successful today.
Well, the access is certainly limited to this refuge. I mean, it's either by air or maybe circle. There are not many points. And the Yukon River Bridge, perhaps.
Right, that's about it. Circling the Yukon River Bridge and by air.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
And that what that does is, what that has done historically, it really limits our access and it limits public use. So, you know, the majority of the public use on the refuge is by local residents, although we do have people that regularly use the refuge from Fairbanks and outside areas. And we have a small number of people from Fairbanks that fly in and trap on the refuge during the winter months. We have a couple of guides that take clients in each year on the refuge. We have a number of floaters that come down Beaver Creek and get into parts of the refuge, but not too many people float all the way through. And then, of course, you'll have a lot of international travelers that come through to float the Yukon River. So we've got that public use also. So it's hard to document all that public use because it's so remote and logistically difficult to do. But generally speaking, we don't have a lot of public use just because the access is somewhat limited.
I think it's a great example of a well-run refuge. I mean, you know, we have the Yukon Cuscone Delta as well, which is very similar, I think, in a lot of ways. But I think it's a healthy situation, the way it's set up right now. Who knows about the future?
Right.
Yeah. We've covered the topics I was interested in covering.
Good, great.
Did a great job.
Thanks.
This map certainly is, I agree, it's very useful. You know, Congress didn't want them to have a complete block like a reservation, so they made those checkerboard pattern. And they've been trying to fill that in, but not too successfully in most, because there are other lands that are probably more interesting to them. Doyon and others.
Yeah, like I said earlier, I think the strategy was to try and maximize the footprint so they could work together to, you know, if they had some opportunities for, you know, resource extraction of some sort, whatever it is, that they could work together and, you know, they'd have a large area to make a go of it. But there hasn't been a lot of, historically, there just hasn't been a lot of successful resource actions up there. I mean, I remember years ago, Fort Yukon attempted to grow rice up there for a while, and just to try it out, that didn't seem to work out. There's kind of a biomass project right now that they're looking in to see if there might be some timber to harvest up there, but, you know, there's a lot of good white spruce along the river, but when you get off the river, it's a lot of black spruce, and you know there's not as much, not as much fuel there, you know. So it's a tough, you know. People on the landscape here have always lived off the land, and that's very challenging to do. But there really hasn't been a lot of variation from that. Most of the employment within these villages is government. There's village councils and there's city governments in Fort Yukon, for instance. You've got regular aircraft, regular flights going in every day to all these villages, except maybe irregular trips into Birch Creek, for instance. But most of these villages have got regular air service, and that provides jobs also, and it's how they're transporting goods back and forth as well. Mm-hmm. We have a little bit. We have a couple. We have some entrepreneurs in Beaver and in Fort Yukon who are catering to the visitors and tourists. And they've got regular. They've got year-round operations where there's a lot of Japanese tourists coming in, for instance, to see the Northern Lights, and they get to tour some of the, you know, subsistence fish camps in some of the villages.
Do you think Congress, well, the people who were making the wildlife refuges, I think they were trying to get ecosystem-wide packages to protect a significant area so that it wouldn't have too many impacts, it would have its own area. Do you feel this does pretty well?
I think they were very successful with Yukon Flats on that, because I think it's as you can see just looking at the map here, it's one big contained area. It actually connects with, it connects up with the Old Crow Basin over in Canada. It goes up, that's actually a natural connection for this. And so, of course, that's across the U.S. boundary. But it you know, when they were choosing lands, I talked with some of the biologists. Actually, matter of fact, I talked to the biologist last week who was in on some of the selection proposals here back in the early 70s and then again in 1978. And Yukon Flats was really one of the government's higher priorities to make happen, because it was such a good intact basin, and it included several watersheds. It contained several watersheds, and it was just a unique area. And I get into the whole diversity discussion like I had at the very beginning. There's really nothing like it. And I mean, this is part of interior Alaska, but if you go west to the other parts of interior Alaska, you get into the Canutia, the Koyukuk drainages, all the downriver drainages on the Yukon River, there's nothing like it. I mean, we've got, I would say that the Yukon Flats has similar habitat types as these other areas to the west, but these other areas to the west are more homogeneous in that they have maybe fewer, a little less diversity. And this area is just like a melting pot of habitat types. So it just makes it very unique. There's nothing like it in Alaska.
That's a good sound bite. A melting pot of habitats.
Oh, I gotta write that down.
It's good. Okay,